Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
Thank you very much. As has been said, James Gowan isn't so much a forgotten master as, for quite a lot of people, an unknown one, and an unfairly unknown one, someone who's been very much overshadowed and whose partner, James Stirling, has been remembered not only for the subsequent work, but also has tended, particularly in the eyes of younger people sometimes, to have been effaced from the earlier work for which he was at least an equal partner, I think we will find, this evening. I'm not going to say much more, but at this point, rather, just introduce the two speakers. Ellis Woodman trained as an architect, but has spent most of his working life as a journalist, long-term, really, with Daily Telegraph, and with a variety of architectural journals and also Spectator, and is currently the director of the Architecture Foundation. Above all, the reason why we've invited him tonight, in a series where we're wanting a historian or a critic and a practicing designer to both reflect on the same figure, is because he is the author of really the most definitive work on James Stirling. James Gowan. I've done it. Which came out just a few years ago. One of the other things we're going to be talking about quite a bit tonight is how Gowan, unlike Stirling, was not just a designer, but has really left his influence in a much more, perhaps, long-lasting and subtle way, in that he was such a great teacher as well, a very charismatic and very influential teacher. And Tony is not only well known to most of you as a designer architect, as someone particularly well known for a series of galleries, but also someone who was taught by Gowan and has a great respect for him as a teacher himself, for his work as a teacher. And I think, as will become apparent, here we have someone who was able to work in a variety of styles according to what was needed in the job, rather than trying to promote a single house style for a practice, but also someone who perhaps because of that was able to develop students in a variety of styles that were theirs and a variety of idioms that were theirs. And the roll call of who he was responsible for teaching, I think, is quite phenomenal, and that, I think, will come out in the course of the evening. So I'd like to hand over first to Ellis. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. I suspect for many of you have some sense of James's kind of body of work, and I thought, given that we have quite limited time, I'd really kind of try and talk more about the kind of abiding themes that preoccupied him. And in particular, I'd like to talk about the subject of style, which is something Judy just alluded to. And I think is a question that he was kind of endlessly preoccupied with and theorising about. I'm going to show you a few buildings, but I'm also going to, towards the end of the slide presentation, I'm going to focus on some things I don't think many of you will have seen, which is images from his really extraordinary body of sketchbooks, sometimes relating to projects that are in the office, but often just a development of ideas, kind of just speculations, and don't necessarily have an end beyond the making of a drawing in sight. James's family have just negotiated the transfer of his archive to Drawing Matter, the trust which you'll find their website, which is very beautiful, drawingmatter.org, and they've just up to today put the digitization of the earliest of his sketchbooks online, relating to the 1956 expandable house, which was kind of done in kind of during the period he was with Stirling. So I think that's a taster of what I know is going to be a bigger program of digitalization and exhibition and publication around the archive. This is just first image from one of the images of the sketchbooks, but maybe kind of gives you a kind of sense of the tone of a lot of the work. But let's move on. So, yeah, I wanted to start really with just start thinking about this kind of subject of style. I think it's kind of significant that James's education was split by the war, and his initial education was at the Glasgow School of Art and was a Beaux-Arts education. And then subsequently he studied at Kingston. So he had this kind of rather unique kind of perspective of two very different, experience of two very different architectural, educational kind of cultures. And I think he certainly, as much as he was a modern architect, he sort of brought a sort of informed skepticism to much of the promise of modern architecture kind of through his experiences of a Beaux-Arts education. And of course, the subject of style is one that's very much foregrounded in the kind of Beaux-Arts education that his, you know, they've been looking through his archive. There's still there kind of very remarkable sort of double elephant drawings where he's been required to kind of draw out the classical orders at kind of 5-1. And I think particularly this, in our conversations, was a subject that he returned to repeatedly with was this distinction between the Gothic and the classical, which is obviously something kind of that he would have understood initially kind of through his time at Glasgow. But I think in James's perception by the towards the end of his life, the perception he'd sort of he'd reached was that he said to me that if one's trying to talk about what the characteristics of modern architecture are, in a way that the mid 19th century the attributes the superficial attributes of the two styles fall away, but the underlying configuration implicit in classicism and Gothicism, these remain as really the only two choices you have as an architect. That if you're a Goth, you're interested in a loose assembly of forms that kind of sit lightly on the ground, you're interested in changefulness and a kind of dynamic relationship of the parts. And if you're a classicist, you're interested in a in buildings that kind of sit squarely on the ground, that have a kind of taut profile, and which have a kind of static mass and a kind of obviously symmetry is kind of part of that the classical idea. So James always maintained that he was a Goth and Stirling was a classicist, and that Stirling, if left to his own devices, would always work towards a kind of symmetrical, static form. And James's impulse was always otherwise. And there's a kind of drawing I know he made late in his life of looking back at all of his built work, and you find that it's universally kind of structured on an ad quadratum grid, that there's a kind of 5 foot or 6 foot or 3 foot bay system which is dictating the organization of the form. I want to kind of identify those two kind of ideas of style. I think there's still questions kind of about the expression of buildings which obviously remain. This is a quote from just John Summerson, which from Heavenly Mansions. So I think a lecture he gave at the AA in 1947, in the war years. Running through the whole of modern architecture, one's aware of this curious reservation that it's not architecture, but the relation of architecture to everything else, which has been the architect's concern, that he has not sufficient confidence in his own art to believe that it can be anything more than a neat prose account of this or that situation, a correct answer to a rather complicated examination question. So I think this is a sort of critique of functionalism, which is very beautifully kind of framed there. And this question, this sense that functionalism was not enough, is one that certainly a number of architects across the world of James's generation, I think they were very alive to that. I think you find someone like Sarin, and maybe in America as a sort of equivalent figure. And I think, as Judy alluded to in the introduction, there's this phrase of James's which became the title for the Banham Review of Leicester, the style for the job, which was really a principle that Stirling and Gowan's later work certainly took very seriously. The principle that each building, its architectural expression, should derive from the task at hand. So Leicester is a building in the engineering style. It's a very explicit attempt, almost like a kind of architecture parlante, a kind of Ledoux sort of idea, I think, there's a kind of correspondence between form and function, but ultimately goes beyond functionality. That issue of the style for the job really is kind of central to the reasons why Stirling and Gowan split, ultimately. The context was the initial development of the scheme for the University of Cambridge's History Library, which, as you know, is a project that Stirling went on to realise on his own. It's Stirling's design. James Gowan was sceptical about the project, and on a number of grounds, he sort of articulated to me anyway, a central one was the sort of improbability of that language being appropriate to a history library, a language which had been developed for a building in the engineering style. What did that mean translated into this very other brief? This is little him talking of the 70s, and I'm going to quote two pieces from this amazing interview by Sherbin Cantacuzino from the AR. It's possible to support the argument, but only just that each building should be a creative experiment in first principles, with examples such as Van Nelle, Maison de Ver, Falling Water, each of which operates a particular vocabulary taken to an extreme limit, rather like an engineer's bench test to destruction. In a sense, Leicester does this. The style is pushed to a technical breakpoint, leaving nothing more to investigate. And if one really accepted the implications of the manifesto, a fresh language would have to be conjured up for the next building. But on most occasions, time and other limitations inhibit any new and perhaps prolonged inquiry and press one into rehashing exhausted vocabulary. I think James's counter-proposal to the Stirling, developing Stirling scheme, there were a number of grounds that he had problems with, particularly, I guess, its classicism, this idea of its symmetricality on the 45-degree angle was something he was very resistant to. The sense of it being a rehash of a style, and also I think he felt that they'd pushed the technical possibilities of Leicester to its absolute limit, the idea of patent glazing sort of being hit by 80-mile-an-hour gusts of wind he was nervous about. And certainly at the history building, there were kind of well-reported technical difficulties that ensued. His counter-proposal was to make a building that had a severe exterior, that had a robust and kind of plain exterior in a way, and where the energy went into the development of the interior. And this was, in his mind, I think, a kind of related to his fascination with Robert Adam, and more broadly with a kind of a tradition of Scottish architecture. But I think he thought, both from an ideological point of view and also from a position of practicality, that might be a way that they could go, but Stirling wasn't interested. That idea of a building finds its way into the Schreiber House, the project that he built after he left Stirling, up on Hampstead Heath, and this kind of extraordinarily grand house for the period, which was, I think, a source of bewilderment to some of the critics at the time. But as you can see, it's a building with very kind of rigorously deployed kind of plain exterior on a kind of this 3-foot-wide bay, which organises everything from the brick piers and the openings, the glass openings, down to the precast concrete floor structure which you see inside, and the bespoke plywood furniture that he designed for the building. So this is an essay which touches on really this preoccupation. When one's discussing buildings of plain fabric, an elaborate interior, one finds that many of these are associated with the name of Robert Adam. The dialectic between exterior and interior is peculiarly Scottish. in the sense that the castle is the model, whilst the English discard the type when fortification became unnecessary, or at least accept substantial modification. The Scots still had to contend with weather, or choose to make a priority of such defensiveness. The distinctions between style and usage is polarised by two building types. Indeed, there are only two such classifications, all buildings being variants or hybrids of one or the other. The pavilion, open, extrovert, fashionable, etc., and the castle, closed, secretive, timeless, etc. The house on Hampstead West Heath is in the ladder cat genre, as are several others in this rural locality. It forfeits extreme external and public display for reasons of both weather and taste. And within, it's preoccupied with the concerns of exacting family use and their fulfilment. And yet, often in James's work, I think these poles of he talks about the possibility of the hybrid between the castle and the pavilion, and this, I think, which the later 1967 swimming pool built at the Schreiber House, I think, is of that type. Again and again, you find in James's work this preoccupation with the earth mound, the earth bund, the kind of defensive bund, which is, you know, there as early as the Brunswick Park School in Camberwell and extends through to the hospital work that he realised in Milan in his later year. This is really, it's more of a paddling pool than a swimming pool, in truth. It's not very deep. But you can see that also this, in addition to this ad quadratum geometry that I was describing, there's a kind of series of projects which are exploring circular plans, including the house in St. David's for Professor Park, the client at Leicester. Just taking forward this sort of discussion about style. This is a apartment which didn't last for very long. I think it was built in 73, but it was... I think I've written that wrong. I think it was finished in 1969 and it was demolished in 1973. In Park Lane, and you can... Yeah, the kind of... You can sort of see... I guess the thing I'd like you to just take away is the kind of strange diversity of languages which are kind of concurrent in this one apartment. From the kitchen, kind of... feels like something kind of Kubrick-influenced, perhaps. Kind of working with this bespoke plywood furniture system that he'd developed with Schreiber, his client on the Schreiber House. But then the kind of neo, kind of pop Georgian sort of living room in the bottom right, and this kind of entrance space, which actually is entrance hall, which is sort of planted and retaining certain existing features. And this apartment, when it was published in the Architectural Review, was the subject of a very entertaining and sort of vociferous sort of interview with Sherban Kantor Kasina, whose name I see I've misspelled at the top. And I think the interview was the headline was multi-style. It was addressing this kind of the concerns that Kantor Kasina had about this stylistic diversity within one project. So Kantor Kasina says, some of the rooms in this flat are stylistically inconsistent with your earlier work and not even consistent with the style operating within the same flat for the kitchen, bathrooms and dressing room. Are they a compromise in which the clients played an important role? Rather than withdraw or recommend another architect, did you accept the client's taste in the way that an architect in the late 18th century might have turned from Gothic to classical at his patron's request? It was that sort of situation, James replies. The flat was designed one room at a time, starting with the kitchens and bathrooms, where the clients were quite happy with a modern refit. So too with the dressing room, which is a 30s flavour. But a garden was required in the entrance hall. Existing pine panelling had to be incorporated in the study. And the last room, the living room, had to be in the Georgian style. It would have been possible to ride roughshod over these requirements, to have declined the task, or to have suggested another architect. But the problem would have still remained. One would merely have disengaged oneself from it. It would not even have been possible to regard any of these actions as giving one a moral edge on the situation, unless, on another occasion, when a client said he wanted the best possible modern architecture, one declined and suggested someone more competent. It's very kind of, for those of you who heard James speak, it's sort of very characteristic humour. While that project's happening, James is teaching. I mean, he's been teaching since the 50s. And, I mean, if I fill in some of the names of people who he taught, it's in the 50s he taught Richard Rodgers and Quinlan Terry, Christopher Woodward. In Tony's period, there were people like Piers Gough, whose image of the ICI research facility you see at the bottom, and Paul Shepherd, this extraordinary, if you can make out the drawing, the helicopter on the far left maybe gives you a sense of scale. This is the Playboy Bunny Club on the Wiltshire Plain. I think with maybe a Playboy Bunny being kind of crucified, kind of in the middle of this sort of pagan ritual. But they are these gigantic figures. So I and Tony will be able to kind of cast more light on what was going on at the time.
No, I'm not going to.
And both of these images are from the publication on the left, which is which James edited, and the covers are beautiful, one of his designs. You know, later I should say that, you know, when he was at the Royal College in the 80s, he was teaching people like Alex de Ryker and Stephen Taylor and Stephen Bates. I'm sure there's other people in the room today. But I think he had this extraordinary ability to work with the preoccupations of a very diverse range of architects and to allow them to come into their own without ever actually kind of imposing a style on their work. And maybe we can talk about what it was he brought to that brought to them later. These last images, I thought I'd show you some of these amazing sketchbook images, which I know are going to be more widely distributed, kind of hopefully soon. James wouldn't appreciate my photography, but these are just some snaps I took the other day. And yeah, as I say, they're kind of. They are almost a sort of parallel project, kind of with, and you'll see, I hope, in some of them how they interface with the work. But they're often drawings which are, I think, kind of produced in boring AA council meetings and kind of stuck in kind of subsequently. Every page is absolutely considered, often a whole idea for a building. Kind of presented and dispensed with in a page, and there were some that I'd love to see built, you know, some of them there. But this is what is this? I don't know that this needs comment. But these are 1978. They're all, I think, the ones I'm showing are a bit of a hodgepodge from the 60s to the late 70s. And so yeah, there's certainly this. I think this kind of preoccupation that you saw in the student work with reuse, with the working with existing imagery and associative imagery and giving it a kind of surreal new life, is sort of running through a lot of this material. And there's kind of a whole series of drawings which kind of relate to the kind of possibilities of taking very familiar vernacular kind of forms and how you might, through a process of addition and subtraction, develop a kind of a new vocabulary. These top ones, well, there's a particular project kind of he sets in 1973, kind of at the AA, three related projects, which proved enormously popular. And the first, all of them to do with this principle of reuse at different scales. And I think the first project was, I forget the Palladio Villa in question, but there's a particular facade drawing in the RIBA's holdings of elevation for a Palladio Villa, of which that's the only drawing that exists of the scheme. And this was presented to the students, and they were invited to develop a project on the basis of this drawing. The other project, he had some bits of metal formwork which had been used in the production of the Schreiber furniture lying around the office, and the students were presented with this object and asked to make something out of it. And then the other third project was his own office, which was on the first floor of the big house at Linden Gardens at Notting Hill that he lived in for many years. The studio was a kind of L-shaped configuration, and the students were asked to develop schemes for turning this one room into an apartment for a couple. And this was sort of at the moment of the oil crisis, and I think there was a sort of understanding that the positivism of the 60s had maybe kind of run its course. The top left is some reworkings of this Palladio facade. I think the one at the top right is maybe kind of showing how these investigations are beginning to inform the housing at East Hanningfield, which he would go on to do. And the bottom left is his submission as part of this kind of Palladio Villa project, as it were, which will come up again. That's the East Hanningfield scheme. The roof is almost invariably a kind of a demonstrative aspect of James's buildings, and this striation forming a sort of a binding structure. And this is, that house I'd shown you previously. I think this is the sort of final drawing, which is, I think, I have a memory that this was a proposal for a kind of fresco almost, a mural, where the house had been transplanted to a Scottish loch. And I think what you're looking at in the middle is maybe a bridge structure with almost Ledoux-like sort of the water flowing through. And then there's this sort of curious figure, which perhaps relates to his fascination with Duchamp at that period. But I think also this idea of the Gothic and the classical, as a sort of confrontation between the Gothic as an assembly of parts, in its most explicit way. There were kind of drawings for useless structures, as he called them, which sometimes find their way into more purposeful kind of resolution, like in the bottom left, a sort of chair. Leicester sheet, there was a picture of the model that he'd made of the roof structure for Leicester, and this is very much the same sort of way of thinking, but kind of obviously to a rather kind of freer ends. This preoccupation with pipes again and again. And a sort of modularity that you find at the architectural scale and also at the furniture scale. Yes, this one on the bottom right is I think you can make out little people kind of standing on floor slabs. So this is a proposal for a building where these big tubes would effectively form the structure. And what's fascinating about the sketchbooks particularly is endlessly returning. The dates in a way don't matter because he's endlessly redesigning past projects or coming back to picking away at kind of things he's done in the past. In Leicester, there was always this sort of question in his mind as to whether the tower was really warranted, kind of certainly in functional terms. There was certainly a need to have a water tower, but that didn't quite translate into the why you might stack the offices into such a high structure. So these are a couple of the one on the top, I think, certainly is thinking how that might work if the offices had been lower. And then some more, really some quite kind of almost like Japanese metabolist things, I think, on the bottom right. But you can kind of see the connections with the kind of culture you would have encountered at the AA. So there's a kind of series of projects of gigantic animals, and there's a very funny bit where I'm in the book that we did where I'm completely the straight man, but he's explaining how they would have been made in plate gold. There's a giraffe at Greenwich where the long legs are very useful for the tidal conditions. And a pig in Brixton, which would have worked in the, kind of some of the lower, the less well-to-do parts of London. But yeah, those ones from the writer kind of that early 70s period, and he talks of them again as sort of monuments to the three-day week. They're kind of critical, in a way, thinking of them as being coming out of H.G. Wells' sort of War of the Worlds, of these great terrifying objects which might land and give you a fright. But the ones on the left, I think, are his entry to the Milbank Housing Competition of 1977, which sadly Nicholas Lacey won instead. I think that this one on the top is maybe of more of a realistic entry to that scheme. But then there's this image I love at the bottom, which is this kind of, again, a confrontation between, I guess, a Gothic and a classical image, with the dog as a sort of symmetrical structure, and yeah, Leicester sort of transplanted into the Thames. So that I hope gives a sort of some sense of this, his humour and his very kind of open, irrational kind of artistic sort of sensibility, which kind of wedded to this incredible sort of technical competence and reason. And you know, I think maybe from the writing, one understands what a rigorously rational mind he had at some level. You know, that he was able to bring these two qualities of his persona together, and I think it's a hallmark of, you know, real artistry. Thank you.
I was taught by James, it turns out, at the moment when those last sketchbooks were being made, and he was compelling because, of course, Leicester was still an extremely powerful building in the mind of students. And James was a considerable figure. You know, his reputation as a teacher was very great. But I think what has coloured my view of him, perhaps wrongly, is that his ability to reason got... I think he began to understand that reason couldn't deliver everything. And as a person whose formation had not only been in the Beaux-Arts, but actually, of course, because he was of his generation, very much confined by modernism, I think he began to see the limits of reason. But I think he was a modernist, not in the sense of being a modernist in architecture, but a modernist in the other areas of thought that which are occurring. For example, his interest in Duchamp was very unusual for architects at the time, and the irrational. And he said to me that he explained the value of sketchbooks, which were that, in his words, they were the place where an architectural idea could be recorded before it had to become a practical entity of a building. And so in his teaching, he stressed the need for sketchbooks. And years later, I attempted to mount an exhibition at the Architecture Foundation in its former days and wanted to show the sketchbooks, and James got about three out. And he intimated that that's all he had. There were more, actually, but he, for reasons best known to himself, he implied that he'd only got three sketchbooks. And I said, but, James, I have 550 as a result of your teaching, and I don't know what to do with them. But when I came to make this lecture, I realized very late that I didn't have any photographs of James Gowan's buildings, except for the Schreiber House, which I visited with Ellis. And Ellis was so punitive about my photography because I had a Leica which was very long, so the pictures were at an angle. So I had to edit them out so he couldn't jeer at my photographic skills, because James was a considerable photographer. So I was hard-pressed. You know, I'd, of course, left it too late. And I did have photographs of James's work, but they were all in slides, and I knew that that was going to be impossible. So I resorted to looking at the books of James that I had, and decided to attempt to photograph photographs of the building out of the book. And then, as I looked at the books, something more interesting occurred to me, which is that if you look at the very few publications that he made, first of all, they give a... Because the oeuvre was very small, they give a rather good view of all of his projects. But also, as with all architects, each publication showed how he'd thought and rethought about his work, and that's what happens when one publishes. You reassemble the work in a different way, and that's what I hope to show. But I also hope to show that aspect of his work, which I think was independent of his reasoning, and which somehow existed in the later sketchbooks, which was this ability to shade off into the surreal, but also, in the end, through not very adequate photographs, I'll admit, to show how his hand and eye worked independently of anything that he said. And that's one of the most important aspects of an architect's work, is that what they actually do in an involuntary way, that's where their talent is revealed. But bear with me, these are a lot of things to extrapolate from a number of books. The first book I want to talk about is a book of his writing called Style and Configuration. And it's full of arguments. I mean, the range of his issues are very great and disparate. And it has this beautiful introduction of the kind of sketch that editor so eloquently let us see. But in one of the pages, there's this would have been very current in the minds of students he taught. There's on the top left-hand side, there's a detail of the way that the structure of the Schreiber swimming pool is connected to the concrete base. And then underneath it, there's some plumbing from a house in New Cavendish Street. And then below it, a roof extension from Middlesex Hospital done by a talented filmmaker. And then the side up on the right-hand side, the side of a building outside the AA, which was once a theatre, which has a very inscrutable quality, and made even more inscrutable my photography. But it has a long moulding and windows which are placed at random, and there's something in that James found very compelling, which was outside his reason. And then building, which is kind of renowned in a way to some people, which is in Langham Street, the tiled building. And then finally, one of the handrails from his house in for Schreiber in Hampstead. And then on another page, there's, and this is an essay about all sorts of things, but there's at the top, there's a tensioning member for underneath the table in the Schreiber house, and then a Tonet chair detail, and then a glass house. And so although he uses by way of illustrations of an argument, it's that his eye was going somewhere else. His eye was, I think, operating above his reason. And, you know, here we have a much more understandable compilation of a castle, a pavilion, and then the Schreiber house. This page of projects where Sherban Cantacuzino really took him to task for the disparity of the project. And for me, there's a slight hint of one always has jobs that you have to do in order to produce income for the practice, and it had some of that quality. But also, above that, I think James hit on something which would later become quite an accepted modus operandi, which was to eclectically gather together different styles and put them together. But if you look at the photographs, there's this kitchen, which reoccurs in a different form in the Schreiber house. It looks like an operating table, you know, and you think of the surreal imagery of a sewing machine and an operating table, and then there's this space, and then all of this, which... but perhaps the most telling phase is that in part of it there's an arch, and this does something I don't fully understand, but then the juxtaposition probably useful, but the juxtaposition with the furniture that he designed, you know, these curves rhyming. So if you're... I think he was a great composer of architectural objects, and that's quite rare. And in some of the later photographs, I'll attempt to explain what I mean by that. And then a page of drawings. At the back of this book, there's a catalogue, Raisiné, and he's chosen to put housing he did in Greenwich next to the interior he did in Mayfair, which is ironic. And I asked my friend Paul Notley, who I think is here, who worked in his office as an assistant, why James consistently redrew his projects. And Paul said, I don't know. I don't know why he did that. And then he ventured, I thought, a brilliant idea that James, because he had long periods where he didn't have very much work or no work, would redraw the projects in the same way that a musician between widely spaced gigs would practice. So perhaps that's the reason why he drew. And then, you know, the rather obvious but compelling combination of the Schreiber swimming pool with the house that he did in St David's in Wales, a circular one. And then, you know, drawings of a warehouse and drawings of a housing project or a housing study. And then the second publication is this by Academy Editions, which has this very striking image on the front where it's split. You know, you would expect that and the other side of it to be parallel, but it's not. And then his explanation was that there would be, in daily life, there would be an interesting destabilization of the usual. So he, in a way, he was dealing with issues that the Smithsons were dealing with much more explicitly, but in a much more, in the way that an artist might. And this book showed really early projects. The house, there's a Muse house, which I like particularly, and I think it's destroyed, the interior is destroyed, but it, you know, it has some of the elements that you see in his later work. And then this rather extraordinary house for, I think, a lecturer at Leicester in Wales, a holiday home, which he explained as being a way of producing the minimum amount of surface, you know, for heat loss. There was some kind of curious modernist functionalism ad absurdum. But, of course, it was impossibly difficult to live in, I imagine. But James said the minute you introduce a curve, the cost goes up. Yes, of course it does. We all know that. But and I have a later photograph of it that I retrieved from the web. But and then in the middle of it all, an essay, you know, of the type that Ellis has spoken about, you know, the justification for the Schreiber house, and then the Schreiber house itself, which is was very controversial. I hope to explain that as I actually talk about it in actuality and, well, in the photographs that I have. And so this kind of page, which, as we'll see from the later publication produced by Dak Blog or Blog Dick or whatever they're called, Black Dog, sorry, the ones that do all the, that will have five typos on the page, spell Venturi's name five different ways on one page, which they did for Alan Colquhoun. Won't let you do this. You know, you can't put graphic design, so you can't see that. But of course, this is a fantastic page full of a drawing, you know, I mean, really packed, and it shows, in a way, James's the evident intensity of design on this project. And, you know, the swimming pool. And then the furniture, this furniture which he designed with Heim Schreiber, who was the client and was a furniture manufacturer. Beautiful, in fact, and his house was full of it, which was lovely. And then housing East Hallingfield, which was a commercial proposition, which now he's been kind of absorbed and I won't say decimated, but the tragedy that we all know is that an artistic idea it's very difficult to survive in a quotidian environment, and you know, James, I imagine, found that out. But as a thing in itself, a very beautiful composition. I mean, really strikingly good compositions. And that when I teach, interestingly, for the last 5 or 10 years at places like ETH or Delft, there's an absolute inability for students to understand how a facade is made, and one explains to them that, of course, it's a plan has some evidence of occupation. You know, one can hold on to that as a human being. A facade is something different. A facade is more akin to clothes, where it has both the function of keeping you warm, but also of expressing something, of making a gesture. And that's the hardest part for students, because that's a completely black art. But James, in his reasoned way, got to that. But actually, he was a very, very good designer of facades. And then, you know, inexplicable kind of things like this, which I can't possibly hope to, but beautiful drawings like this. Fantastic drawings, really. And then in Trafalgar Road, and also further along in Greenwich, these housing schemes, which are, I mean, for reasons only known to himself, there's a drawing of it in Decor, you know. And there was another one, I think there's another one of it painted white with palm trees and camels, you know, in a sort of rebuke to the Nazis saying that modernism was corrupt and very austere. James said, complained that people thought his style had gone all 30s. And but then this one, which it's eclectic, and now you would do it. I mean, in the Red House that I did, we did precisely that. And whether this was in the back of my mind, it allowed me to make every single room different, to be sourced from different places, to make an architecture which never fully came together in an exposition of those stylistic forces within it, and which one hopes was open to interpretation by the owner and by the client. And this certainly was open to interpretation by the client. And so while James was obviously at pains to defend himself against Counter Casino's fear that he'd lost his way, also I think in his deep spirit somewhere he understood the artistic potential of this kind of allowing a client to dominate the scheme and yet extracting something deeply artistic from it. And that's quite a considerable thing to do. And his point was that at the time of making this, that the attitude of most modernist architects was that the client should be told what the right pathway was. I mean, this is, of course, a slippery slope, but it's legitimate and about the expression of a broader culture than that of architecture. And again, you know, these strangely operating theatre-style kitchens. But this is a project I particularly like. It's in a school dining hall in South London. It still exists. I think you can visit it from the outside. But it was three spaces, roofs pointing in different directions, and then a flat roof, and then it's all mounded with a chimney. And this child forever, he's probably in his 60s now, probably forever frozen in a position of humour. And then the choice here of photographs of Leicester, which don't show the complete building. You know, they show aspects of the building which I suppose intrigued James. And this is what I mean about each publication showing a different way that the architect will think about their work and combine the projects with other projects. This was a factory for Heinz Schreiber, which never got built, but this is a very compelling image in the 70s. This massively distorted single point perspective was very, very compelling. And then he built these warehouses in Bermondsey, which I've never seen, but look rather wonderful. You know, that all of this, obviously, I imagine the job of sort of ordinariness was invested with all these passions for Italian rural buildings and modernism. And there they are, sort of languishing away in South London. But he gave me this catalogue of And he was very generous. He gave, you know, he gave things away, and he gave me this catalogue of the Schreiber furniture, which I particularly like. And that's how it was made. And then this is the final publication, which was which Ellis Woodman produced, with an extremely long essay, which you had to remove large amounts of invective about other architects in his time, unprintable stuff. And then I wrote a rather impassioned piece called Magnetic Fishing about his teaching. And you can see, you know, that now you can only put one image on a page, and it has to be on shiny paper. But actually, also in a way, what happens is that contingent events have a way often of reflecting a deeper situation. So here is the last book that I imagine James thought ever would be produced. And in fact, that was true. So each project is very clear. Each project is presented with a great deal of clarity, and the images are chosen with a great deal of singularity. And you could see, you know, a different choice of photographs here. And this was the moment where somehow I think he knew that this was the last thing that would be said about him. And that person permanently must have incredible leg ache, you know, afterwards. And then Lester, but, and so we go on. But, and then the Schreiber House. And much more different photographs of the Schreiber House, much more plastic. And then the house in St. David's. But I think I'd like to move now to some photographs which are the edited photographs, are the ones that... No, I'm going to move to this. Why was Lester so important? Well, Lester was important because, of course, they took the motifs which Melnikov had developed, which were taken by the modernists to be pure functionalism. It's actually not true. If you investigate Melnikov, he was a mystic, and it was a strange place that he inhabited. But at the time, these were absolutely emblematic to architects in post-war Britain. And we have to think that there was a period when, in the 20s and 30s, when there was a substantial, well, not substantial, but a good white modernism. And then modernism really was reformulated after the Second World War and put into use in public buildings for housing and education. But what was really shocking here to modernists like the Smithsons was the use of these as symbols. And Peter Smithson rather cruelly called Stirling and Gowan, Styling and Gowan, you know, because they had a. But you could understand it. I mean, with the Smithsons, they were attempting to build a new basis for architecture with a social base, and they were attempting to extend out of early modernism. And so for them, Stirling and Gowan would have been very perplexing. But it's only a short step from this to the IMA. Scheme unbuilt for the Hague Parliament, which used emblems of modernism in an absolutely frank, expressive way. And so it was a project whose influence was both great in that, as students, it represented something to us which we could work with, which we loved, and yet it also had a much greater resonance. And like a lot of James's work, and I see a lot of James in this, more James Gowan than James Stirling, I'll admit. Like a lot of James' work, its messages have great continuity, but they were never, in a way, what I'm appealing to here is the artistry of James, which he probably didn't understand himself. But if we look finally at the Schreiber House, I mean, he made some difficulty for himself, because to make a building like this at that time to use engineering bricks like this and to separate the building into verticals was a cliche, in fact, and used in lots of other buildings. But if I look at this more carefully, what I see is an understanding of a fenestrated Georgian house where you have an array of window in solid, but done in a different way. And actually tactile. And notwithstanding what he says about the elaboration of the exterior not being consequent, it is. If one looks at these windows, they have proportional relationships and they are meaningful and they're not simply an outcome, which is what a lot of modernism proposed, you know, that facades were an outcome of some other process, as Summerson said, has said. But the inside is deeply influenced by Adam, Robert Adam, not Caruso, and the fitted furniture. I mean, this is all original and it's all still in use, or it was when we were there. And my point is, and James' point was, that it's habitable. If you look at it, it's a house which this really did. Unlike the East Hanningfield housing, this house really was able to do what was proposed to be an art piece and yet an inhabitable one. But elements like the staircase are really beautiful, really beautiful objects. You know, there's a decision to break the stair at the landing, and then there's a handrail, which one for a child and one for not. And then we all know that if you do that, if you get these, you know, depending on how you get the treads to meet, the handrail jumps or it curves. And then a fixing at the top. But then a staircase to the basement, which is a sort of miracle of bronze, all bronze, and with the glass stairs. The craving for a decorated ceiling that many architects have is somewhat satisfied by a constructional element which has its raison d'etre in modernism. Nearly there. I want to talk about this. This is the side elevation, the completely inconsequential side elevation of, I think it's Creek Road. And why am I talking about that? Well, if I'm talking about composition, what interests me here is the way that, first of all, the surface is allowed to be a surface, you know, it's enjoyed, and the fenestration doesn't destroy it, and the solid doesn't destroy the fenestration. And then this open element, which is has a roof on it, is compared with this, and then these are compared with that. And forget the pitch roof, that was put on later by some Philistine, but and the house, which James explained rather neatly through heat loss calculations. But of course, like all work, it should be and is enigmatic. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.